history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that might just raise your eyebrows if you take a little time to listen. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey each time, boy, do we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories. And the stories you're going to hear today are some that I doubt you've ever heard before, unless you've picked up the book, The Smell of Kerosene, written by 87-year-old Don Malik of Lancaster, California. And this story goes back to the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania area, Neville Island. Tell everybody where Neville Island is.
Neville Island's about 11 miles to the northwest of Pittsburgh. The Ohio River turns up a little bit at Pittsburgh and goes to the west. And Neville Island was actually that. It was 7 miles long, half a mile wide at its widest. And many years ago, it was an Indian reservation. And then when it became settled, it became a garden spot for the city of Pittsburgh. They used to raise truck gardens down there. And then they would pull them by barge up to Pittsburgh. This is many years ago. But then, as they approached World War One, industry noticed it was a nice place to put some factories and things because of the shipping and the river. And so one half the island turned out to be industrial, but they kept it controlled where the other half was residential. And it was about half and half. And I, of course, lived on the residential. And my father was working in one of the big industries with Gervaux Corporation. And that's where I grew up, on the island.
So you're a boy there, and you're thinking, you know, someday I'm going to be playing around with this unbelievable aircraft that's going to help us land on the moon someday. That's what you thought about as a kid, right?
No, not really. I tell you what. I think I was a pretty normal kid until about I was 11 years old and Pearl Harbor was attacked. And I was 11 years old. My older brother, I just had one brother, he was 17 and in high school. And we knew almost immediately that he was going to be in the service because World War II, a lot of people today aren't familiar with it, but it was really a national effort, a big mobilization of soldiers, sailors, and factories and something else. But I was aware of things about then about war and fighting. And when my brother enlisted, he decided he wanted to fly, and he enlisted in the Army Air Corps, and he had always been my sort of hero and always looked up to him. So during the war, we followed him all the way through his training and through his missions over in England when he's flying bombers and things like that. And we were always crossing our fingers and praying that we were going to get him home because a lot of the boys didn't get home, a lot of them. Mm-hmm. But he made it. He got back. So that was great. And then when I got out of high school, which was 48, the war ended in 1945, and I got out in 1948. So I went off to college. That was sort of a thing to do if you had the support and you were capable of it. I signed up and went to Penn State for a couple of years. Didn't graduate, but in 1950, June of 50, I had 2 years in, and I knew what the requirements were for flight training. I'd been tracking that all along because watching my brother go through all this and hearing all these stories when he came back home, I wanted to fly.
Was there a particular story or two that you still remember that your brother told you?
Well, he told me some pretty tough ones, too, and I think it sort of steals you, and maybe it would discourage some people. But they were shot down on one mission where they limped down into Belgium. They were hammered pretty good with flak. I don't think fighters got them, but they lost engines and others were running rough and they barely made it into an emergency field in Belgium. And that was sort of a spooky one. But the one that really hurt to hear it and hurt him to tell it was one of his classmates, a fellow named O'Brien, was flying a B-24 off on his right in formation on the bombing runs. And he just disappeared in a puff of smoke. They got hit with flak pretty heavy. I know that set my brother back a lot. And I thought about that too. And I thought, well, that was war. And I'm sorry it happened, but I'm glad my brother made it through and got back. So I think in a way to still want to get into flying and do flying was sort of a good base for me. Otherwise, when you're in the flying game, you lose a few people along the way, training command and operations and everywhere, and it's something you just sort of have to accept, and you always say to yourself, well, that wouldn't be me. I'd avoid that. Well, sometimes you do and sometimes you don't. But I think stories like that were impressing me on just how important and demanding flying was.
Well, and I was struck by that in reading your book, guys that you describe as supremely talented pilots who you had great respect for, who died. And this wasn't in combat. This was in test operations, a very dangerous job that you carried out as well. But you mentioned your brother. It was Bob, right?
Yep.
Your book is dedicated to your brother.
I dedicated it to him because I got into the, well, because he was my idol and because all he had done in the war, and that was a primary reason. But I used to think of him when I was going through the Navy water survival training. And we used to say to each other, the Navy must think we're going to jump out of the airplane and have to swim all the way to shore and not get picked up by a ship or helicopter. They made it so tough to get through their training. And when I was a kid, small along the river, I hadn't learned to swim yet. I'm not sure how old I was. May have been six, seven, somewhere in there, but old enough to play along the river. So my brother was going to teach me to swim, and he helped me out from the shore to an area where there's a big boulder underwater where I could stand on that boulder and tread water in the current, because the Ohio River was always flowing, had a current. So then he went ashore, and he waved at me, time for me to learn to swim to shore. So I treaded water for a while there, and I finally decided he wasn't going to come out and get me, so I took off for shore, and I was splashing and kicking and doing everything in the world, but I made it to shore, and then I thought, well, I can swim. But when I got down to the Navy thing, I had to learn to swim again. They were even more demanding. But I thought at the time, he'd have been a good Navy instructor on swimming. Tough.
Yeah, it's a wonder you survived that moment with the strong current of the Ohio River.
Yeah.
And you describe in your book those days when your brother's off flying bombing missions in Europe and you're at home, and you paint a pretty powerful picture that I think communities across our country experience then that most people today don't know about. You talked about the blue stars hanging in the window.
Oh, yeah. Well, what it was, when you had a family service member, you would put a blue star in your window. If you happened to have two of them, you'd have two blue stars. And when people would look over to home, they'd say, well, they've got somebody in the service, somebody in the Army. And when they lost somebody, when somebody was killed in combat, that blue star would turn to gold. And I know we always said we don't want any gold star at our home. We want to stay blue. We sweat and prayed for that during the 4 years of the war.
Well, and that's, I usually am spending these times with guys who are fighting in that war. You weren't old enough to, but you're experiencing it. Your brother's life is in jeopardy there. And, I mean, I just imagine that as a young kid entering your teenage years, that it had to be a pretty sobering time.
It was. And what some of the things that we did, everybody was into the war effort. I think my dad was working 6 days a week. Some people worked 7 days a week. In the schools, they were selling what they call war stamps. And you get a book, and you could buy saving stamps. I don't know if they were 25 or 50 cents, but you could buy stamps if you had small change, which was to help the war effort. And when your book filled up, you could turn it in and get a war bond. And that was a big drive. They were really after money to support the war. And they had posters out everywhere. When I was a kid, I was old enough, I'd go and along the river where some of the companies were dumping slag and things, and we'd pick old pig iron up and junk metal to sell the junk man. He'd come through in a little truck. They wanted all the metal they could get for the war effort. And so people did that. Everybody was involved in that WW2. It was just something different. Some of the current combat wars or exposure we have, I sometimes feel sorry for the soldiers because sometimes they don't get enough recognition. They're doing the same thing the boys did in World War II, but much smaller scale. I support two or three veterans and handicapped veterans and wounded warriors, and each month I'll send off checks to some of these charities, and I favor those ones that favor the veterans.
I think there's a lot of people listening to you say that, nodding their head in agreement with you right now. So you decide that, just like your brother, you want to be a pilot. Did you have an idea of what kinds of planes you wanted to fly or what kind of flying you wanted to do?
Well, I had a general idea. My brother always told me, He wanted to fly fighters, P-51s, but he didn't get assigned to them. They were looking for more bomber pilots than fighter pilots. So he always had that in the back of his mind or craw. So to me, fighter pilot was a goal. In 1950, I'd finished my second year of college, but the thing about it then was the Korean War had been getting hot. I think it had started before June of 50. It was ongoing, and they had the draft was still in place from World War II. They had never canceled the draft. And so as I come out of 2 years of college, I faced two things. I could go for the third year, junior year, and maybe get drafted, because they were drafting out of colleges, or I could sign up. And I had enough time, 2 years of college, to get into flight training. And so I decided right then, hey, no question now, that's where I'm going. I've always wanted to do that, and I've always wanted to get into flying, and there was the opportunity. My roommate, fine gentleman, he's passed on now, Howard McCullough, Howard told me, he said, well, Don, he said, I joined the National Guard because I want to finish, get my degree. We're both in engineering. He said, you should think about coming to the National Guard. You might not be called up, or you might be. And I said, no. I said, I'm going to sign up. So when I got home that June, I went up to Pittsburgh to a recruiting place. And I went into the, which was, I think it switched over to Air Force now, from Army Air Corps. I think the change had happened somewhere in there. But anyway, I went in to recruit, and a guy took down the early dating, and he said, well, you're too young for our training, cadets. This was Air Force. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, 20 and a half is our minimum. And I was 19. I said, where's the Navy recruiter? He said, down the hall. So I walked down the Navy recruit because I knew they were taking them younger. I hadn't even thought about being a carrier pilot at that time or Navy, but I thought, well, I wanted to go into flying. That's what I would do. So I walked in there and I said to the guy, I said, well, I've got 2 years of college, like sign up. He said, how old are you? And I told him, he says, here, take this. So he gave me a little test, and I took a test. He gave me another little test, three or four tests, basic stuff on math and stuff. And I passed all those, and he gave me a ticket to Akron, Ohio, for a physical. And so I was in the Navy. And they said to me, when do you want to report? And I thought, well, I'm just coming into the summer. I got a summer job. I said, how about September? And they said, that's fine. So they put me in for September of 50. And I went down to Pensacola.
And could you have possibly imagined the kind of machines that ultimately you'd be operating?
No, I think in a lot of professions, too, sometimes, and you go into it, and sometimes with young people, it's hard to convince them not to look too far ahead and too much about the big picture, but to do it in plateaus and work to it. And that's what happened to me. And I wasn't going into flight training saying, I'm going to be in test flying and do this or do that or test something that helps them go to the moon. I wanted to go in and fly, learn how to fly. And they taught me the Navy way, and I was a fighter pilot, so I learned to land on carriers. And I did a tour of 4 years. And when I was coming to release time in the Navy, I'd been married since I had my commission for about, well, we were married in 52. So about a year and a half or two, we'd been married, had a little girl, the oldest one, Sandra. And I talked to the wife, and the Navy duty and the carrier duty was sort of trying in that you'd go to sea for 6 months, 4 months, 9 months. We had one cruise. So you're in and out all the time away from home. At one time on a short cruise, my wife stayed in Jacksonville and kept the apartment, and she had a job with a phone company. But on a 9 month when she went home, she went on back home, because that's a long time. So she stayed back in Pittsburgh with her folks and my folks. But we talked about it. And I said, I don't think I want to do the military career, because there were fellows in my squadron who were senior, and they had teenagers in high school, and they were still doing this cruise bit. And so it was something you had to put up with if you wanted a military career in the Navy in that area. So I would come out. I went back to college and finished up Florida in engineering. I knew I wanted to fly, but I knew I had to have an engineering degree to get into that next plateau we're talking about, like test flying. And so I finished that up, and I was very fortunate. I came right out of college at Gainesville, June of 57. Uh-huh. And I found a job at Langley, NACA, and they had a couple people in competition, and they evaluated everything, and I was fortunate. I got picked sort of the right time, the right place. And I went right from college, basic Navy flying, into NACA test flying. And of course, I was a junior test pilot, and I was in training with that group. Those are the senior pilots, older pilots, worked with you and brought you on into the test field.
And you say NACA, and most people don't know what that is, because you were involved with NASA before it was NASA.
That's right. It was the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, and it was formed way back when. What happened. This country decided somewhere back in the early 20s that they needed to put some money into research, aeronautical research, because the countries in Europe were doing that. French and English, they were doing some testing and developing new flying machines. So they formed up a committee, National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, had a lot of senior aerodynamics and people with it in propulsion, and they formed up that center at Langley. It was always referred to as a mother center, was Langley, Virginia. And that's where I found the opening and went in the competition and got the job there. And they had a variety of things there. They had the helicopters I mentioned earlier, but they had some fighters, F-100s, 101s, and F-8s. And so it was a great place to go. And then they checked me out in some of the amphibians and moldy engines that they used to run supplies back and forth to at Wallace Creek. So you got to the attitude or the mood that you could fly anything.
Well, and looking through your book, it sounds like you flew just about everything. And maybe let's start there before we get into some of the specific stories. Let me ask you just some dumb questions and see what kind of good answers you can come up with. So how many different aircraft do you think you've flown in your life?
I've tried to keep track of them, and my best estimate was 125 gliders, helicopters, and airplanes, different variety, fighters and bombers, but 125.
Helicopters, jets, lunar landers, everybody, you know, puts that trio together, right?
Yeah, quite a variety, yeah. I had over 11,000 flight hours.
What's the highest altitude you've ever gone to?
About 80,000. That was in the, I also flew SR-71s, Blackbirds, and that was the ones that we cruised at 80,000.
And we'll talk later about what it looks like from up there and what you can take in from there. So that's the highest you've been. What about the fastest? What's the top speed you've reached?
I did 3.2 Mach, which is about 2,200 miles an hour, and that was in the Blackbird. That was a cruise speed. That wasn't stressing anything or thing. You had to stop there because of heating, but that was the design speed of the propulsion system and the structure with 3.2 Mach.
I think we can all agree that is some serious speed. Don Malik was a NASA project test pilot for the SR-71 Blackbird and its predecessors, the YF-12 and the XB-70. His career from the early 50s to the late 80s spanned some incredible advances in aviation. He's written about it in his book, The Smell of Kerosene, which you can link to online at hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's conversation with 87-year-old Don Malik, an accomplished test pilot who helped pave the way for some significant advances in aviation. He grew up around Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, idolizing his older brother Bob, a decorated World War II bomber pilot. And Don started out as a Navy fighter pilot during the Korean War era. If you read his eye-opening and thorough book, The Smell of Kerosene, there's a lot you're going to learn, including a training apparatus I had never heard of before.
You mentioned in there something called the Dilbert Dunker. Oh. And I bet most people listening right now have no idea what a Dilbert Dunker is.
Well,
but it made sense given what had happened to so many pilots in World War II.
Yeah. Well, it was part of the Navy water training. And first of all, you had to pass what the Navy said, AAA swimming course, which meant you had to swim so many yards underwater. And when you come up to the surface, they had a pretty big pool. you had a technique of splashing the water away, getting a breath of air and going back down. And that was in preparation for swimming under burning oil or fuel. If you got into something and it was burning above you, you'd have to stay underwater. So that was pretty long. And then you had to swim a mile without touching anything, just a mile. And then you had to jump off of a high platform into the water, which like maybe you jump off a carrier deck or something if you had to. But then the dunker, that was sort of the crowning blow and test of the Navy's water program. And it was in a big hangar building over a pool, tall building, probably 2.5 stories. And there was a structure built with about a 45-degree track on it, angled track. And it run from the top of that hangar building right into the pool. And on that track, they had a cockpit of a SNJ, just the cockpit portion where your pilot would sit. And what you would do is you would get into that with a parachute on. Usually it was waterlogged parachute, old parachute. And you'd strap in and at the top of that thing, and they'd release it. And so you come sailing down 45 degrees in this thing, and you crash into the pool, into the water. And shortly after you hit it, it turns inverted and sinks towards the bottom. So when it stops, you're upside down. You're not on the bottom of the pool, but you're near the bottom. And your job is to unbuckle and pull yourself down towards the bottom of the pool, away from the canopy bow, to clear the parachute. You don't want to drag your parachute to get it caught, and then get up to the surface. And it sounds pretty spooky, and it was pretty spooky, but I thought, well, I can swim and I can hold my breath underwater. And the big thing was you had to keep your cool. And we had a few guys that panicked, but the Navy was aware of that. And they had divers on each side, safety guys, Navy divers. And once in a while, they'd have to get out and bring a guy up. And sometimes he'd be bleeding from the head or something where he got panicked and he'd come up too quick and struck the structure and stuff. And so it was a confidence thing for you. If you're flying off carriers and you happen to go in the water and went underwater, you just didn't give up completely. We had one fellow go off our carrier, and he had what they call a cold cat shot. He didn't get a good catapult shot, and the jet went in the water, crashed straight ahead. It didn't break up too bad, didn't blow up or anything, but started to sink. And so he pulled the emergency ejection, which was supposed to have the canopy go off first and then the seat come out, and nothing happened. It didn't work. And he's sinking all the time. So he reaches over and he hits the electric canopy switch. Canopy opens up. The battery was still hooked up and it worked. And he let go of his belt and he swam up the surface and the helicopter got him. But that was sort of one where kept his cool. Something didn't work that should have. He tried something else that did and he made it. But that was the Dilbert Dunker training. That was to give you a feeling of confidence and went through that and did it. So.
Yeah, I wonder if they put that at Disneyland, how many people would get in line.
I don't know. Well, I think they'd have to brief them pretty well and have divers standing by.
Oh, yeah. Well, and you mentioned your fellow pilot who kept his cool. And I know there are a lot of times you had to keep your cool because you were in some dicey situations. And maybe that's another broad question I can ask you. Have you kept count of how many times you had a crash landing?
I had one helicopter accident in Virginia, and it was a specially rigged helicopter and a special flight control system and two pilots. And it was an older Navy helicopter. It was an old HO3S, and it had a characteristic of ground resonance, and that's sort of a hard thing to explain, but in essence what it is, when a helicopter touched down to the ground, if it wasn't firmly on the ground, like when you first touch on, and the rotor system gets a certain harmonic going, it just goes into a resonant vibration really bad. And there are two things you do when that happens. You slam it on the ground or you try to pull it in the air. And I was a safety pilot in that chopper, and I had a pilot in the back. Bob Shambham was the evaluator pilot. He was looking at all the crazy electronic changes on it. And I tried to pull it back in the air. We experienced ground resonance, and when we did, that old helicopter was limited on controls, and we just slowly rolled up on our side and stopped on our side. The rotor was all chopped up. We unbelted, I turned the switches off, and we climbed out through the plexiglass windows. That was my primary crash in an aircraft in my career. I've had emergency landings with, you know, engines out and C-47s and things like that, but no other crashes.
Well, there was another account I read in your book that sounded pretty hairy, at least to me, not having the experience you have. And I think you kind of glossed over the 1950s before you went back to college. You were in the service during the Korean War. you didn't go fly missions over there until the war had reached a stalemate, but you were over there in Southeast Asia during some real tense times where you guys kind of anticipated air-to-air combat against the MiGs, right?
Yeah. What happened was we were all trained and going through all our ordnance attack training in Florida, and the war was still going on. And about the time we deployed out of Norfolk, they signed a truce, but the Navy was scheduled. We were relief carriers, so we appeared over in Japan. So we did patrol. I flew a couple missions escort where they had reconnaissance photo planes going, which were sort of classified on what they were doing, but that's the closest I got to any interesting thing. But then we were cruising in the Sea of Japan in the winter, blowing cold snow and everything over the deck, and doing oval patterns because they were holding the position the carrier was staying out there, pretty big oval pattern. And all once somebody come in and said, "We're going to the south." I was up in the bridge, and we've been on a southerly heading, and feel the ship. Well, when the old carrier, it was the USS Wasp, World War II carrier, we were running jets off it, and when it picked up speed to really go fast, vibration through the whole ship, and it's because of screws, and I guess the shafts were old or something, but it was okay. We just knew what we were going fast because in the wardroom, the glasses would be jumping on the table. So what happened was that's when the French were getting pushed out of Indochina, which was turned into Vietnam, I guess, but in those days, we called it French Indochina. They were getting pushed out. The Air Force was flying in parts and supplies for the French who they had given Bearcats to. I think they had some F-8s and maybe some B-25s. But anyway, the Air Force was still supplying the French. And the word came out that the Chinese had moved a couple of MiG squadrons down to the border, and they thought they were going to maybe try to jump those transports. Well, the Air Force had no close airfields for their fighters. They couldn't get so close. So we picked up that assignment. So we went down there and cruised in that South China Sea, and boy, it was like from snow in the, what, at night to sunbathing the next day down there. But we had airplanes on the catapult. We had them stripped of all the rocket rails, and we had what we call Mach 2 tape, which was real heavy green tape. And they taped all the openings and surfaces to smooth the flow for our performance. And we had the guns, four cannons loaded, and it was sitting on a catapult hooked up. And we could get in and get off in 5 minutes is what it was. And so we were on patrol down there. And once in a while, we'd see a contrail to the north, which was MiG circling. But they never came south. They never came down towards the transports. And we flew caps all the time. We were flying missions and patrol. We weren't flying. We had those planes ready on the catapults to go. But the French, then they folded. And they come out of there. When that happened, then the U.S. pulled back. So that was a pretty close one. But we were sort of anxious. We were briefed. It was interesting. The Navy was real good. They brought in some aircraft intelligence officers. And they briefed all the fighter pilots on the performance of the MiG and how worked against our performance and how we had to fight them, what arena we wanted to get them into if we engaged them. And that was pretty impressive to me. I thought, well, I'm glad they have that. It's good information to have to go in there.
But you were flying Banshees at the time?
We were flying Banshee 2s, which weren't up to the MiG in performance and speed, but the Banshee, if the MiG would turn with you, the Banshee could not turn them because it was a slower, bigger wing on everything. So there were areas that we were briefed that try to get into them, and if you couldn't, then do the best you can.
And there was another story in your book during this time period that, for me, it reached out and grabbed me as I read your description of it. You were talking about being on the carrier when there were pilots in the air, but the weather got so bad there was no way for them to land. And the way you describe it, the entire ship is praying and thinking some of these guys are going to die.
Yeah, that was Operation Mariner, and that happened on our way to this cruise to patrol in Japan. And it was in the North Atlantic. There were three carriers. One of them was British. The North Atlantic weather in the wintertime is bad. It's stormy, rough seas, and we didn't even like to fly off it because sometimes a pilot would be coming aboard, they'd get a cut, and they'd land, and they'd break the landing gear, and they would write it up as a pitching deck. It wasn't a pilot error thing. It's just the fact they're trying to get them aboard when the carrier deck's going up and down. But anyway, I was number two that day, and my squadron leader, I was on his wing, Bob Hamilton, number one, and full tips, and we had a patrol scheduled, a mission. I'm not sure where, but normally in a carrier, that's what you did. You went off on a combat air patrol mission. Sometimes you did intercepts on other planes from the other squadrons, everything, for training, bringing each other. It was always training. But anyway, we cranked up for launch, and it was crappy weather. It was overcast, but you could see a mile or two. We were there, and my old wingman, Bob Hamilton, his nickname was Hambo, and everybody had a nickname. They taxied him in front of me onto the elevator, and I thought, what in the world? He must have a mechanical problem, a maintenance problem, because we had full tips. They didn't like to take you down the elevator because they couldn't fold your wings with full tips, so they had to take you down. So he disappeared, and I thought, well, I'm going to lead the rendezvous. So I started making mental plans. I was going to be the first one off, and the other two guys behind me would be rendezvousing on me. Next thing I know, that elevator came back up, and they taxied me up onto it, and I just about got stopped. They gave me the engine cut thing, and down I went, the hangar bay. And as soon as I got down hangar bay, the engines were just winding down, and a bunch of sailors pushing me back out of the way. They're bringing down there. So I got down in the ready room. And I said, what's going on? They said, well, they stopped launching the jets because there's a 3-degree dew point spread. And what that meant was you were pretty close to maybe forming fog. When it closed up, when the air temperature was approaching the dew point temperature that close, then you couldn't take a chance. So they launched propellers from three carriers, propeller aircraft, because they had longer endurance. But they were smart enough not to launch the jets. Well, that's when it went fog, 00. That was trying even on the guys back on a carrier like myself. Everybody in the ship was sweating it because the carrier kept trying to find some visibility where the guys could come in. And they had a recall because it's shortly after they launched all of them. I think they had 43 airplanes in the air. Shortly after they launched them all, bang, 00, fog. I mean, it was fog. You couldn't see. So they tried a few approaches with the radar guppies, and I was up on Pry Fly for a while, and one of those guys went by. We never saw him, but boy, that big 3350 about blew you off the Fly Fly, and I thought, I'm getting the hell out of here because I got down below. No reason to be up there then. So then they decided they're going to send him to a submarine. The submarine had surfaced about 100 miles away.
So they're just going to ditch.
And they were going to ditch because mm-hmm. the submarine had a couple hundred feet ceiling. So the guys could come in under that ditch, but the seas were terrible, rough. And so they were making estimates like they'd be lucky if they could get 50 of the guys back if they ditched. And in the meantime, the carrier and the rest of the task force is cruising as best they can towards the submarine area. The guys are on their way to the submarine, and they started to break out on the carrier. Not break out a lot, but get up where at least you could see a little bit underneath. And by gosh, they recalled them, and they got them all back on board. They had some really dangerous cuts where the pilots did a super job of getting onto the flight deck where they just saw the carrier at the last minute. And some guys landed on a British carrier and some of the British guys landed on the U.S. carrier. Whatever carrier they could find under that soup. And they got them all back aboard. Well, the story was that the admiral of the fleet put a lock on communications. He didn't want that to get out because if they'd have gone through that ditch, that'd have been really a black eye for the Navy. You know, losing all those crewmen and everything. So they locked it up for a while. But the story I heard was a chaplain, and of course the chaplains were praying on the ship, and they were praying on the public address systems. You could hear it in your bunk rooms and everything, the prayers, and pray with them for the pilots who were in the air. This one chaplain wrote to another one who was on the shore somewhere. He somehow got it out to him, and the story got out. And the story we heard later was that they give this poor old chaplain a reprimand. I think he was a Navy commander, but they gave him something in his jacket that was negative. But then later it came out. But that was it, and that was spooky. I almost get goosebumps thinking about it again because I almost put myself back in that small bunk room listening to on the PA and the stuff.
Well, that's got to be a helpless feeling. I mean, you described when we're talking about the Dilbert Dunker, the whole point is to put you through this extreme circumstance so you have confidence if you're ever in that scenario.
Yeah.
But you talk about this.
Yeah, this is something nobody could control or handle with that 00. I think today, with the modern carriers in their automatic instrument landing systems, they might be able to bring a guy down through that and get him aboard okay. They've made a lot of advances. But in those days, we didn't have any of that. We had paddle wavers, LSOs out there, and you had to see them pretty early and get your signals and respond, get your cut, and come aboard. We always talked later years, we said, yeah, we were the first jet flyers on a World War II carrier. It didn't have an angle deck. It didn't have this, and it didn't have that, but that's what they had at the time.
Well, and another thing that stood out in the accounts I read in your book was you had one carrier landing where you almost ended up like that friend you talked about who ended up in the water. You were just barely saved on top of the deck.
Yeah, that was in a Banshee, and I think it was about my 12th landing, and that was on the USS Roosevelt on my first cruise. I came aboard, had a pretty good approach. The seas weren't that bad or rough or anything. Wasn't a bad day. And when I took my cut and I flared to land, I felt the hook pick up a wire, but then it released, and I kept going down the deck faster. Another one, release, another one. And I thought, oh, crap. And at first, I'll be honest with you, the first thing I did was take a swipe at my hook handle, because I thought I'd forgotten to lower my hook. But you don't get away with that because the LSO's watching. If you don't have a hook, they wave you off and everything. But anyway, that was a natural response. My one landing gear, my left landing gear, engaged the barrier, and it was designed to engage both landing gears to stop you. And that was a Davis barrier, they called it. And it was only about so high above the deck with cables. When it caught one side, it slewed me around, pointed me over the port side of the ship to go over. But I was far enough down the deck that the right wing tip and tank caught in the final big nylon barricade. And that was to keep airplanes landing from crashing into airplanes parked on those old straight deck carriers. But that barricade caught my wingtip and it stopped me. So I stopped pointing at the edge of the deck. And things happened so fast, and here you are looking. So I shut down the engines, and of course they had to get everything pulled back. And the first thing I did when I got out of the airplane, I went around and looked at that damn tail hook, and it was broken in half. Well, apparently when I first touched down, that nice round smooth hook that picked up the wire had split in half, but the half, which the cutting edge, stayed on the hook arm and the bolt, and every time I pick up wire, cut it in half. I think I cut three of them in half completely, and I kinked a couple before I finally wound up with the barricade on the side. I think when you're flying like that, especially with, you're sort of competition with everybody. You all want to do a good job, and everybody's striving. You don't want to do anything that's pilot error, pilot goof up. You always try to avoid that. And when I saw that broken hook, I thought, well, there's not much I could have done to avoid that structural failure. So down the ready room, and Captain called down a little bit, and he said, this captain of the ship, I want to congratulate that pilot of my airplane number. He gave me the longest foul deck in history because they had to replace three wires, or at least a couple of them, replace some of the kink ones. And fortunately, the guys that were still in the air had enough gas to wait. But that was a bad one as far as screwing up the flight deck. It had been better if that hook had just gone completely and hit the barriers and stopped, but it was cutting those wires.
Well, that was the kind of record he didn't want to break, but when we come back, we'll hear about Don's role in preparing NASA to put the first man on the moon. Don Malik's book, The Smell of Kerosene, is available online. It's linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we're going to come right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days, I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Don Malik. He lives in Lancaster, California, not far from Edwards Air Force Base, where for years he was on the cutting edge of aviation advances. He'd been a Navy fighter pilot, gone back to school to earn an aeronautical engineering degree from the University of Florida. He'd flown for NASA's predecessor, the NACA, in Langley, Virginia, before heading to Edwards in 1963. By that time, Don was married with four children, but unfazed by the inherent danger of doing things in the sky that no one had ever done before.
I like the idea of the flight tests, sort of looking in the unknown or proving things or discovering things, and it just seemed like it was a high interest to me. And to go out and take a flight test card out, like on a Blackbird, and do a really good flight and complete all those points and get that data, That was very meaningful. And if you were not, you had some problem either with the airplane or with you, with the way the tests weren't, you come back okay, you say, well, that happens, that's okay. But you always look forward to the performance. That seemed like a challenge to me.
But you also knew how dangerous it was. And you've got a wife, and then you end up with four kids, and you're still doing this stuff. I mean, how do you balance that ever-present danger?
I think early in a career, I'll go back to flight training and tell you about down in Cabinets, Texas, where we're flying the Hellcats, learned to fly the Hellcats. We lost five cadets in about 5 weeks out of that training command. Now, two of them were mid-airs, where they lost two airplanes and cadets at once. But anyway, it was right before Christmas, and everybody was nervous, all the cadets, including me. And I thought, you know, we're only a couple of weeks from the Christmas break. I wish these Navy pokes get their act together and just stop flying for now, let everybody take a little leave break and settle down and then come back. Not the military, not the Navy. We flew right up to the scheduled date, and that's the way they had to do it. I recognized that later. But then you say, well, I didn't know any of those fellas personally. There were another training squadrons around, the same base and everything. But none were close to me. And what really gets to a person when they're a friend or somebody close to you, you know them. You appreciate them. You miss them. Whereas somebody down the hall or somebody you don't know or haven't met or anything, he's sort of a number and you're sorry he's gone, but that happens. So you sort of develop an iron curtain or a feeling in yourself where you say, hey, it's part of the business. I'm aware of that. It's not going to happen to me. I'm going to be too smart for it to happen. And a lot of times they're pretty smart guys that get killed. But you have to have that approach to it. You can't worry about it or think about it or let it bother you.
You say, it wouldn't happen to me. I was too good. I was too smart. And then you said, there are a lot of smart guys who got killed.
That's right.
And in your book, you talk about some of these guys. And it seems like every time this happens, you're stunned that it happened to him because he was so talented and so skilled.
Yeah, that's right.
How often do you think about those guys?
Well, I think about them now. And I walk in the garage. I've got pictures on the wall of them and everything. But I don't let it beat me down or anything. I just think about, well, I had a great experience with those fellows. I worked with them for a period of time, and they were lost and gone. And it's hurtful, but I try not to let it influence the way I carry out the rest of the day.
When you think back about those test flights, are there a moment or two that you found most exhilarating or exciting? And are there some aspects of your time as a test pilot that you look back on now and say, that's what I'm most proud of?
The LLRV was the biggest national known program that I flew on because we're getting it ready for the moon mission. Bell built the thing, and they shipped it out here in parts. Bell Aircraft wanted to test it, and a lot of times the companies test the vehicle before they turn it over to NASA or the Air Force. But Bell wanted to test it, but they had an exorbitant fee, real high fee for their test pilot to fly it. NASA said, bring it out to Edwards. We'll put it together, and we'll fly it here. And so we did. So
you guys had to put it together.
Yeah, they assembled it out at NASA, to all the parts.
And for people who don't know what we're talking about, tell them what LLRV stands for.
Well, it's a pipe-built contraption, a lunar lander research vehicle, and it was built initially to evaluate the control powers and the control damping that the people landing on the moon would require to make a safe landing on the moon. We were trying to determine that down here. So this machine was designed to fly like it was in a lunar environment, and that was sort of a unique thing that was done through computers. And it had a jet engine in the middle that would support 5/6 of its weight and had rocket engines that would support the other 1/6, which gave it the lunar gravity simulation. So we would set it up where the jet engine was partially holding it, and we were flying it on the rocket engines and evaluating attitude controls and difficulty in landing. And we were setting limits, and limits were important because if we called for too much thrust, that meant they had to carry more fuel aboard to the moon, and that was always a problem. Every pound of vehicle went on was important, so that was an initial test that we're doing on it. So to start off with, first of all, we had to develop the computer systems and verify that they were doing what they were supposed to be doing. That was initial proof. And then we went into the evaluation of flight control systems and damping. And as we finished up the program, Joe Walker and myself, Jack Kluver came in, an Army helicopter pilot, was signed to NASA. And we checked out Jack, and then Walker was moving over to the B-70, the Houston pilots were coming up, two pilots were coming up. They were going to be instructor pilots for the astronauts because they were going to ship those down to Houston. Plus, they bought a couple more from Bell, and they called the later ones the LLTV, training vehicle, whereas ours was RV, research vehicle. But it was a pretty demanding type program, and it was an important program. And it went pretty well. We were fortunate out here. We didn't have any accidents. Down at Houston, they had two ejections. They lost two vehicles. Pilots made it safe. Neil Armstrong and Philip Land on the Moon ejected down there. And it was just a fact, in a training environment, it was still a very tricky thing to fly. And it had to be very careful, limitations and everything in it. But anyway, when the boys come back from the moon, somebody asked me, well, what do you think about that thing helping them on the moon? I said, I can't comment until they come back. But every one of them come back said, we're glad we had the LLTV training on Earth for the moon landing. And all of the moon landings, the final landing was manual. Pilots were flying it like we did here. It wasn't automatic. I think the approach to it was pretty much automatic, coming out of the orbit of the moon and getting into the vertical, but the actual maneuver and landing was manual on them. So I think that was, you know, a big contribution to the lunar mission. And I was proud of that I was involved with it, but I was also proud of the 9 years I flew the Blackbird and some of the tests we did on it, too. So.
Well, that had to get your adrenaline pumping a little bit with the Blackbird.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a...
What does it feel like when you're going 2,200 miles an hour?
Well, the only feeling you have inside the cockpit is that things are happening quicker as far as getting set up and established for doing test points and changing systems and positions and everything. You're very busy.
Were there any lessons that you and Joe Walker, who would go on to be killed in a mid-air collision in a B-70, were there any lessons that you guys learned the hard way that those astronauts in their training didn't have to learn because you already had?
I'm sure there were, just in basic developing the system. There were things that we had to correct and change on the system before it was presented to them. I think their checkout, Major Kluver was a big one there, checking out their two instructor pilots. That was a big transition of knowledge over to them. You know, you pass that on to the new guys who are going to fly it, and that was important. I don't think there's any super secrets that we discovered that if you did this, it was easy or something like that. It was just a task, and you did it. And the techniques that we developed and everything, I think, went over to them flying it, but I'm not sure if they were all used on the moon landing other than maybe the basic maneuvering qualities of the thing and the vertical control and touchdowns and thing.
Well, and just even those things, which seem intuitive, were so new for you guys. You mentioned you'd spent a little time in helicopters and you've been flying jets, but you get this lunar lander, and I mean, there's nothing like it that's ever really been built, right? It's brand new. It's one of a kind.
Well, they've had some vertical takeoff machines, but none quite like the lunar lander. None where they had the computer and where they had the lunar environment where they had reduced the thrust. That thing even had a cancellation of air drag. It didn't have that much drag, but when you're moving through the air, the engine would tip forward and cancel the drag. So it was just like you're flying in a vacuum, like on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And all the attitude control. So it really had some unique features that were never flown before. Yeah, the vertical.
And I'm just thinking, when you mentioned that Bell had you guys put it together, I'm thinking of all those kids in the 70s and 80s that bought a little plastic model of the lunar lander and put it together in their playroom. And you guys were doing the full-scale model before any of that ever happened. And I think you had some moments while piloting that craft where it almost got away from you.
I had one approach, and it was pretty close, a spooky one. And what it was pilot error on my part. On this ejection seat, you had your own seat cushion because it was pretty critical on the ejection that the rocket thruster had to go up through your body CG. So as it carried you away from the vehicle, you didn't rotate and get tangled on your parachutes. Well, they made some calculations on that Weber aircraft after mine had been issued about halfway through the program. And they said, we want you to use a different seat cushion. It was a little bit higher. And so they did. They put it in. It was probably only that much higher. But anyway, as I sat in the seat and I was flying it and I had my hand on this one collective, my thumb, it was a little bit further up in the collective, which didn't seem to bother me, but there was a trim switch on there. I apparently had got my thumb on that thing, and I got a transfer of fuel into the LRV where it was out of balance. When I flared, and I was using a minimum control speed, we were evaluating the very low-powered rockets, which was dicey there. But when I flared into a hover, it started to roll off, and I had full stick. Well, what I did then, I jumped on a switch that went to both attitude controls because I needed more attitude, and that snapped me back the other way too far, and I went through this PIO type thing, finally getting it settled out, and I landed. Well, when we went back through, I didn't know what had happened even then. I thought, well, they checked the balance, and they said, Don, that one peroxide tank you were trimming from the other side, and it was one of those things, the system was put in if you needed it, and we never did need it. On the thing, the missions and everything were only a minute and a half in the lunar simulation, and it wasn't a need, the transfer was even, but that switch was still there, and I had to justify to myself, why in the world did I do that switch after flying it this long? And I thought, aha, that damn seat cushion put me a little bit further forward, where I naturally reached out. My hand was a little bit higher in the collector, so I'll tell you what they did do. They put a big spring in the switch anyway, a bigger spring.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't do that again. But that was spooky because that was real close to the ground, and I had run out of attitude control, and the next thing I knew was going to be landing sideways. But when I got that both controls and the new rockets in, powerful rockets, it brought it right back up, attitude. That's something we passed on to the astronauts. They didn't have to do that.
Well, that's what I'm saying. If they hadn't changed that spring, maybe those guys would have come in sideways on the moon.
Might have been.
Let's run through some of the things you did. You chased rockets to evaluate their performance?
Well, that was at Langley, yeah.
You did sonic boom tests?
Well, on the sonic boom tests over at Langley, that was early. First, I think it's the first flight program that was really done. They were interested in overpressures because there were reports around the country where people were getting broken windows and things like that from the military airplanes and all. But anyway, Langley got a program, and they went up to Chincoteague, Maryland, which is near Salisbury, and they put a big line of microphones from inland right out Chincoteague on the coast, right out to sea on boats. They had all these microphones, and they laid out a test range down to Virginia Beach, and NASA procured a couple of F-8U-3s that were in competition with the F-4 and the F-4-1 competition, and the F-8U-3s were available. Military didn't want them. NASA wanted them because they go fast, go high. So another fellow, Bill Alford, and myself flew that program, that sonic boom program, and we would turn out around Virginia Beach and make our acceleration. It got up to, I think we're tops, we're running 60,000 feet at Mach 2 through the gate, what they called it, and that's when we crossed all this measurement on the ground. And sometimes we could get a second run in, a little lower Mach number, have gas for that, depending on how it went. But that's what we were doing off of the coast. And the first time I started up there, and at Crusader, it was a performer. It would really go fast. I think that's what sort of got me ready to come out to Edwards when the opening came out here, the fact that I was able to fly that back there, because I liked that going fast. But I was going up the coast, and the air traffic controller said to me, NASA, what in the world are you flying today?
Because you're going so fast?
Yeah, because I hadn't seen that acceleration. It really would go. And it was sort of interesting. The engine, it was an early engine, J75, and you couldn't modulate the afterburner. And what that means is if you turned the afterburner on, it was full on or off. If you tried to modulate it, it would stall the engine. And later they improved on it, but it was early. And so when we'd hit Mach 2, I'd have to use my air brakes to hold it back so that my test points were at Mach 2. And we run different altitudes on different days going through there. And that was always impressive to me that I had to put speed brakes on to keep that thing from going faster than Mach 2.
And what was the end result of those tests? Did then they set a limit for the speed?
What they did was they measured the overpressure at various altitudes. So it gave them a feel for maybe what would be breaking windows and things like this as far as the altitude and the Mach numbers. Then shortly after that, it wasn't too long after that, that the military quit flying supersonic over the country.
Well, anything else that you want to speak to, I want to give you the chance, but I realize there's probably one name that I haven't asked you about, that when people hear Edwards Air Force Base and flight tests, the name Chuck Yeager might be the first one off their tongue. And you actually trained under Chuck for a while, right?
Well, what happened when I first reported out here in 63, I was here not quite a year, and Joe Walker walked in one day, a chief pilot at NASA. He said, hey, how'd you like to go to the test pilot school? I said, I'd like to. You got any money? Because it was very expensive for civilians and other types to go through. He said, yeah, headquarters is approved too, you and Fred Hayes. Fred was new too with me there at Edwards. He'd come out from Cleveland. And so we were able to go through the test pilot school, which was really a break to have that because I didn't have it. I was trained at Langley with the old senior test pilots and getting into programs, learning in job training type thing. Well, the test pilot school was very formal and very broad, and it was excellent school. And somebody asked me one time, well, how long do you think you'd have had to fly to get that experience? I said, well, in a lot of test operations, maybe not NASA so much, but with companies and things, you'd have had to probably go at least 3 years to come out with the same experience that you come out of a test pilot school out of 6 months or a year. So it was very concentrated, a good school. Jaeger was commandant. Just before I went to the school, Fred and I went over, I was towing, I was flying a C-47, towing a lightweight lifting body, the shape. I had flown the lifting body on the lake bed behind the Pontiac. We had a tow car that would get it up in the air about 40, 50 feet, and then you cut the line and make a landing. And so I'd gone through that, and it was about my time to fly it, but it was time to go to school. Well, Jaeger knew the head of NASA at that time very well, Bickel. He had worked for the Air Force for a while before he came to NASA. Mm-hmm. And Jaeger conned to ride in the lifting body, but they were good enough to give me my flights too, and I was in class. We were all working the mathematics and everything. And old Jaeger sticks his head in the door. He says, hey, Malik, come on, we're going to NASA. And I thought, what the hell do I do now? So I went with him, went over to NASA, and we were flying the lifting body. We both got a couple of flights in it. So when I got back to class with my classmates, they said, where'd you go? What'd you do? I said, oh, I went over and flew the lifting body. They said, what the hell are you doing in this school? I said, same thing you are, learning all the basics here.
Classic. Well, and another thing I guess I have to ask you, and I can tell it's not something you think about a lot, but you talk about Joe Walker, who I know you learned a lot from, you had great respect for, and he died as a test pilot.
Yeah.
You talked about Bill Alford, and you guys did the sonic boom test together, and he died as a test
pilot.
He died,
yeah. Bill did, yeah.
But you're still here. How do you explain it?
I don't know. Sometimes I wonder myself. I walk in out of my garage, and I look at all the pictures, and all those guys are dead, and I think, what the hell am I doing still here? I guess luck of the draw or whatever, but I know there are a lot of good people that were killed. It wasn't their fault. Things happened and it went. And I've had a few close ones and calls and everything, but I was fortunate to get away with them.
You mentioned you've flown 125 different aircraft. Is there anything you haven't flown in that you would like to?
Well, I think the most satisfying program for me was the Blackbirds. I flew those 9 years. I did go out 5 years after I retired. They invited me out, and I flew an F-18, two-place F-18. And that was sort of a gift from NASA and the director out there at that time. I had gone through all the ground school just before I retired, and he didn't get the airplanes ready.
Mm.
And it took them a while to get some good F-18s in from the Blue Angels and get them refurbished. And so I got to go out and fly that one. That was lots of fun. But when I look at some of the airplanes now, like the F-35s and the Super Hornets and things like that, I think, oh, that'd be nice to be able to fly something like that. But I flew something that was just like that in my day. That's today's day, and I'm not flying today.
Fair enough.
It's not my turn.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us your story. Is there something you'd say? Because I think most of us don't spend a lot of time thinking about test pilot programs and what's being developed and the people who have to carry out that dangerous duty. Is there something you'd like the rest of us to know or understand or remember about guys like you who risked your lives to advance technology the way you did?
No, I think they're just, you know, like race car drivers in their career, they go out and those guys are piling up and metal and bending metal and doing things and all sorts of things going on in the world today that aren't too unlike it, risk-wise things. We always had the feeling that we were technically superior. We had looked at everything and did everything. Now it was time to go out and look at a few unknowns and do that, and we'd do that. And that was part of the game. Sometimes they'd bite you, and sometimes they wouldn't.
And as you might imagine, Don has many more stories that would not fit into our radio time today. So many memories from an extraordinary aviation career. You can hear more of those in the extended podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com. And, of course, you can read all about it in his book, The Smell of Kerosene. scene. Check it out. I want to make sure to thank a loyal listener and submarine veteran named Jason Head for cluing us into Don and his unique story. And thank you for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time. I don't think we're going to be talking about 80,000 feet, 2,200 miles an hour, or the mission to the moon, but no doubt we will be reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor. And I mentioned there was more from Don that wouldn't fit into the radio time, but we have some more of those stories here. What an extensive career and what a memory Don has at age 87.
What was it about being a test pilot that you enjoyed? Because a lot of people, they'd be scared out of their minds to try some of that stuff.
Well, I think the first thing was when I went back to Gainesville for the last year, 2 years of college, I majored in aeronautical engineering. And so I was familiar, you know, we had a lot of design courses and courses towards aeronautics and towards airplanes and flying. So that was a good basis to go into flight test with the military flying too, of course, you had to have that. And so I think when I was in the Navy, I was doing what they call maintenance testing for the squadron. That fellow I talked about, Bob Hamilton, they took down the elevator. He was maintenance chief and I was one of his officers. I worked structures and propulsion. You do so many weeks in each one and you were the officer in that group. You had a chief and a enlisted man that worked. But when the airplanes come up with a gripe that they couldn't solve, sometime a pilot come in and say, well, it did this or did that, and they'd work on it, couldn't fix it, or they'd fix it, then I would fly a test flight on it, a maintenance test. And I'd go up and look at it. If it was still there, I would try to describe it to them so they could repair it. And that was sort of satisfying to me, to go up and do a little troubleshooting, you know, on the airplane. And flying it. So I think that was part of it. I thought, well, it'd be interesting. I never considered going into the airlines. A number of my buddies, fellow pilots, did, and they wound up with great careers. This fellow in Texas is a retired American airline captain, had a great career. But I never had that urge. I did some of that flying, even as a NASA pilot, a little bit of it. They had a few programs I did it on. But I liked the idea of the flight test. You can't worry about it or think about it or let it bother you. And the thing that was nice was I married right when I got my wings. I couldn't be married as a cadet. And a wife came into that new, right into that Navy environment, and she knew some of these things were going on and everything. She was aware of it, and we'd talk about it now and then. But she had grown to accept it. But when we come out here, some of the other wives that get after her non-pilot wives and say, well, aren't you nervous? It doesn't bother you? And she said, no. And once in a while, there'd be an accident at Edwards. And our secretary would call all the wives and tell them that it wasn't a NASA airplane because the initial reports had just come out, crash out at Edwards. And they had, over the years, there were a lot of there were crashes, military crashes too. And NASA lost a couple out there. But she'd call the wives, and I thought, well, that's good. She thought, well, she didn't want them to hear it on the radio and then worry till the guys got home. But I think it was just something you accepted. A lot of times in our business, you're not right there. It's not like in war where the guy beside you get hit and goes down. That's pretty close and pretty immediate, or you're trying to save him and work with him. It's been sort of a little bit removed in the flying business where he's off in a mountain somewhere where it happened, and, you know, you're not directly on top of it. Now, I've been on a couple of accident boards, and those are sort of tough on you because you're working on a board trying to feel out why somebody was killed or something happened. I never liked the boards at all, the assignment, but you were closer then to them. But I wouldn't correlate it like that with the military. I think the war thing is those guys are all heroes, even the ones that came home and made it back, in my book, to be out there, people shooting live bullets at you and everything. Something happened to us up there. It was because something failed or we goofed up or something else, not because somebody was shooting at us.
Well, and maybe because you guys are doing things that nobody's ever done before. You're the guinea pigs.
Yeah, in a way, yeah, that's right. We're not guinea pigs, we're flight testers.
Oh, is that an offensive term in the flight test world?
No, I never heard guinea pig.
Well, and I know as you're doing all these test flights, and I'm sure our aviation geek listeners will be offended if we don't get into some of the different aircraft you flew, especially all the folks who listen at Edwards Air Force Base where you finished up your career with NASA. But while you're testing all these aircraft, the general public doesn't know a lot of this is going on, right? Or in some cases doesn't even know that aircraft exists?
Oh, I don't think they know much about the details of the testing. You know, they'll see pictures in a paper of a new research airplane that's being tested, and they'll know things are going on. But I wouldn't expect them to be near as close to it as the guys, engineers, are working up the tests, and the guys are flying the tests, and mechanics are preparing the tests. They're right there. So I think the people just look from a distance and they say, oh, that's good. That's our flight test area. They're doing good for the country, and that's their knowledge of it.
Well, they think you've got flying saucers and aliens out there, though.
Yeah. My mother came out years ago on a visit, and I was flying a B-70. And they had a big hangar out at Edwards, which would house two B-70s. But they were so big, the nose so high, and the personnel entrance door was down below the nose of this one. So I had a NASA van we drove over, and I walked her inside the door, and we stood in there, and she was looking around, and she said, well, where is it? And I went like this. She looked up. Oh, my world, she says. You fly that thing because the nose is 20 feet off the ground, you know, up in the air.
And you said, yeah, I fly it real fast.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure you've heard all kinds of stories and questions. Do you ever get a chuckle out of the things that are out there in pop culture about test pilots, about Edwards Air Force Base? I mean, I guess more famously, Area 51. You ever laugh at some of the stuff that people come up with?
Oh, yeah. I think Area 51 is funny. My youngest son recently took the family to Las Vegas, and they purposely took the kids up there because they'd seen something about Area 51. And I haven't been up there. I flew over it, but apparently there's a little town there, and they have souvenirs and everything, and spacemen. But remember they went back, and they had stories that they found these guys in aluminum foil, and they had pictures of them with big eyes, and they hid them somewhere and all that stuff. But I had one neighbor over here. Poor old Doug's gone now, too. But he believed in UFOs. And, of course, he'd always bug me about that UFOs. And I told him, I said, Doug, all the years of flying, I've seen a few things, that I couldn't explain from a distance and everything, but I never considered them UFOs. I never saw any spacemen or anything like that in all my flying. I said, I don't believe in them. And I said, my feeling is if there were UFOs and the way the world is in the physics and the mechanics, we'd have had one of them down here on Earth somewhere all rolled up in a ball.
Good point. Yeah. And maybe some of those reports of UFOs were really flying some of those test planes.
Yeah, you know, people see things and weather balloons and things like that. I'll tell you what got my attention at Langley one night. I think I was flying Navy Reserve. But anyway, big bright light in the sky going up. And I think I was Jacksonville, and I was flying Navy. But anyway, I was down south of Jacksonville, and a big bright light went up. What in the world is that? Well, it was the early rockets coming out of Cape Canaveral, and they were very secret then. They weren't talking too much about them. Army was testing them and everything, and that's the first time I'd seen one at night, and it was very impressive.
You didn't know you'd be chasing them before long as part of these test duties, huh?
Yeah.
I know you're still in tune with this, and you're still looking ahead. And if I go back in time to when you were flying all these test pilot missions, most of the world had no idea how advanced that technology was. So my guess is the same is true today. What we know that's commercially available or even that the military has is one thing, but there's probably a lot more in development that goes far beyond that, right?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure there's a lot. I don't know now. I try to get an Aviation Week digest file on my computer now and then. I try to keep up, and they're mostly, well, they do military planes too, but they'll talk about some of the problems with F-35 and the Airbus competing with Boeing and things like that, and I try to review that just to keep a little feel, but I know there's lots of things going on that are classified and unusual, and I don't know immediately what they were, nothing secret other than I know they're doing that. They're working in all different areas. That's been going on for years. You don't expect them to quit.
Did you ever have a hard time keeping any of those secrets?
No, the only thing that a lot of the work that we were doing, like on the Blackbird and B-70, were propulsion and aerodynamics and structures and flight controls, maneuvering, and it really wasn't that secret. In fact, as some of the reports were published, and I suppose the Russians could get them if they wanted them at that time, a lot of the military stuff has always been classified. When we flew the Blackbirds, we had to treat all the handbooks and all that material classified. It didn't sit out on the desk anywhere. If it was on a desk, you were there with it. And so we had to adhere to what the military classification was because we borrowed their aircraft, and we had to do that. I flew one little program up at a little lake in China Lake Complex with a Super Piper Cub, and we were dropping a shape. And that shape was classified, even with NASA was doing it. And we couldn't do a mission until a Russian satellite went by because they were afraid it had enough photography, it could get the shape. It was a classified shape. So we'd go up and drop it, and they'd fly it down, glide it, and recover it in parachute. But it was classified. And that was one of the few that I've been on where we sweat the Russian satellite.
Oh, I'm sure there's a million other questions that I could ask you here. I know I did see in your book, you mentioned the LLRV, but there was another portion of your time where you were in a zero-gravity simulator and a pretty primitive one. It was like a big silver ball or something that you guys sat in.
Oh, yeah, no, that was at Langley.
Yeah?
I'll tell you, that was when NACA was first selected for NASA. There was a lot of competition. Air Force wanted it. Air Force wanted to charge the space program. It was a big thing coming. Navy was thinking about it. But the president at that time, Eisenhower, was Ike, I think, and he said, it's going to be a civilian space effort, the space program. And so that's where it started out, a civilian space effort. Well, here are the aeronautics people at Langley, strictly airplanes and that sort of thing for years and years development. Now they said, okay, boys, you're now in space. Support in space. Well, they formed up a special space task group, which went finally to Houston. And, of course, that was a way to do it. They brought in the original seven astronauts and that sort of thing. But at Langley, they were also charged, the aeronautics group, with doing a lot of support research for the space program. They weren't. In fact, as we used to complain now and then, that our aeronautical research was being treated poorly budget-wise because it was going everything was to get to the space, But anyway, and they had some really Jim crack ideas going around. There were stories going around where they said, well, we're going to have to cut all the astronauts' legs off so far because they won't be able to withstand the high Gs of the reentry and things like this. And so somebody designed this big steel ball, and I tell you, I swear they hit it. They had it way back around some buildings. And the idea was to evaluate a pilot or an astronaut to see how he could maintain his equilibrium or his position in space if he was at zero G. Well, how are you going to get him at zero G on the Earth? They're going to fill this thing with water, and he's going to float inside this big steel wall. And it had a little hatch at the bottom that supposedly had explosive bolts on it, but it took hours to fill it. NASA had a mechanic or a technician working somewhere who was a professional diver. He had a license in Virginia, and sometimes they'd call him out of work, and he'd go to a bridge somewhere, and he'd dive to get people out of a car or things like that that had an accident. So he was pretty knowledgeable. And so he was a test subject on this, but they sent me and another guy over to the Edwards Air Force pool with scuba gear. And we were assigned. We were junior pilots, by the way. We were assigned. We were going to fly in that sphere. Boy, when I saw that sphere, I thought to myself, I don't like this a bit, because you're going to sit in the middle of that thing. And it was big, all full of water, breathing devices in the dark. I think you had communication some way. And then they were going to rotate you all around and see if you could tell what was happening on your attitude in zero G. Well, the professional diver did the first and the last run. They damn near drowned. They blew the hatch. Something went wrong. All the water come out. That program ended. But that was sort of typical of the early days when NAC was going over to NASA and they were trying to catch up with things, like cutting off the astronauts' legs and some of these devices. And it was sort of wild for a while, really. But a lot of talented people from NACA, researchers, scientists, they went over to the space group. Mm-hmm. And they did a good job. And the rest of us stayed in the aeronautics side, and I stayed in the aeronautics side. But that was that ball I referred to in there. But I thought, oh, boy. And, of course, it was minute years later, they said, oh, yeah, that was pretty wild, yeah.
There's a lot of ideas out there. Not all of them work.
That's right. And that was the stage where everybody was so nervous and so jumpy and didn't know which way to go and where to get involved, and it settled out. I had a Blackbird flight. I may have put it in a book where they wanted to heat soak the Blackbird 30 minutes, and then they wanted to bend it, heat soak it at Mach 3, 2, and then put maneuvers on it longitudinally. It would bend more than a foot and a half at each end. It was flexible. And so I was coming south on my run, getting pretty close to Edwards, but hadn't quite hit my 30 minutes, and I hit it pretty close in, and I pulled a maneuver, a good yo-yo maneuver on it, and as I pulled the nose up, the engine's inlets unstarted, which was bad. You didn't want that to happen. But it happened at the time, but it did. And so the nose is coming up. Our pressure suits are blowing up. Ray Young was with me in the back. Pressure suits are blowing up. It's harder to reach. I'm pushing a stick all the way forward, watching my G meter, because I didn't want to over-G it negatively. It seemed like it took an awful long time to come over. Well, I finally got it recovered. I was down over Los Angeles in our control room. We had an FAA guy in there all the time when we flew. And he said, can you stay above 45? I said, oh, yeah. I was still above 45,000 after all this happened. And I was turning. He said, you're okay. So I didn't worry about the airline traffic. I was way above them. So I made my turn and come back into Edwards. And they got their data, their bending data, and their 30 minutes and everything. But at the end of it, we had problems where they unstarted. And Lockheed had lost one, not in quite the same maneuver, but the same idea. They were in a turn and it unstarted, and it pitched up and came apart. One pilot survived, Bill Weaver, and the backseater did not. He was struck by debris. They didn't eject. They just got thrown out of it, and his parachute worked. Both of them worked, but the one fellow was struck on the head coming out of the debris. But that was a spooky one on the Blackbird. And, of course, you're concerned about airline traffic, and you're down in the area. That's one thing you get straightened out, and then you get the airplane halfway straightened out, and the engines out of stall, because they would stall when the inlets quit running properly. The afterburners would blow out and all that, so sailing through the air. That was probably the worst one. I had a lot of unstarts and things that were planned. That was part of the propulsion program. We get that thing all up there, and we take manual control of that thing, get everything stable, and we just start tuning those in, let it down, 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 blam, they let go and knock your head around everything, and you go through the restart procedure, and sometimes you'd get back for another point and sometimes not, depending on the recovery. But we did a lot of that work on it.
Sure sounds like you're a glutton for punishment to me.
I think I had a lot of luck. I chased Fitz Fulton and two blackbirds. He flew one, had a special experiment on it. I flew the chase, and they wanted to chase him up to Mach 3.2. Well, yeah, we never had a chase before, did that, but they wanted to do it on this one. So I told the one engineer that was pushing this, I said, you know, if I unstart, I'll never be on his wing to see this thing, material blow off this test device. They had it insulated, and they were going to blow it off and expose the cylinder to Mach 3 air immediately and measure heat transfer coefficients and all. I said, I won't be. Well, they said, we don't care. We want you to go through the wake. So I had to cross through his wake at Mach 3. And as you go through there, the pressure wave is pretty high coming off his airplane. And your inlets sense all that. And my spikes and bypass doors were just working like gangbusters on the panel. I didn't know if I was going to unstart or not. I made it through the other side, never unstarted. And I thought, oh, that was a break. Because if I'd unstarted, I'd have been done chasing him for the day because I'd have slowed up and he'd have gone on his way. Then when he fired the device, that was a problem. He unstarted, and I was sitting up beside him. He started to slow down, so then I had to manually put my inlets and restart, which is sort of a tough deal at cruise speed, but you can do it, and puts a lot of drag on the airplane to keep slow to stay with them. And I got them back into Edwards, and later on Fitz said, I don't know how in the world you stayed on my wing. I said, that was prior Navy training, Fitz. We never break formation in front of the newsreel cameras.
Oh, I love it. What does the world look like when you're 80,000
feet
above it?
When you're cruising up there and you look out, of course, you got the curvature, and it's hard to look straight up because you got that canopy pretty close to your head and the pressure suit and everything. But it's darker as you go off the horizon. They say it's black if you look straight up. But as you look up, you can see the horizon. You can usually tell if there are strong clouds below you. Sometimes it just looks like almost like haze, the clouds that are lower than that, and seeing them. But the only time I really had time to look out too much was in the turn, because when we turned up north, we turned just south of the Canadian border. We didn't want to have to go into Canada because of the clearances and stuff. So we would turn around Spokane south of the border. And in the turn, I'd have it on autopilot, and I'd catch my breath and get my cards ready for the first test point going south. And you could look out a little bit then. You could see that. And it was sort of different shades of blue, and then getting sort of fainter gray going up. But it was different than like 30,000 feet for sure, yeah.
Well, is there anything else I haven't asked you about that you think's important for people to know?
Oh, no, I just had a great career, and hell getting old, getting aches and pains.